I have the honor of presenting tonight's speaker. We have a treat for you tonight. P.Z. Myers is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Minnesota Morris, and he is the proprietor of the science blog Pharyngula, which is at the address listed up there. Some of you may know him as the person who got expelled from Expel while Richard Dawkins was let in. We know him as P.Z. And without further ado.
Thanks for the introduction. As you can tell from the title, what I'm going to talk about is a little bit of science education, a core problem in science education, I think. And I will be making a slightly contentious assertion here, which you can see in the title too. I'm saying there is a war between science and religion. Many people will disagree with me. They'll say, well, they can sometimes get along just fine. But I'm going to say you're wrong, that there is a problem. And really the theme of this talk is I'm going to tell you that there's a war and you better be prepared to fight it. And that what scientists need to be doing is thinking about becoming a little bit more militant. Because you can't just sit back and let the religious run roughshod over you. So it's time for us to wake up and get a little bit more, ornery. Get cranky. Just like me. I'm a role model for crankiness on religious. Okay, so that's going to be a little contentious, because there are people who argue that there's no necessary conflict, and that's fine. I would be happy to have some of you speak up and ask questions and argue with me. So let me just start, though, with saying something that I think we'll all agree on, that there is a core unit that I think all science educators will say is true, and that is that the science classroom has to remain secular. We can't let religion get a foot in the door in the science classroom. And that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you're a hardcore atheist, whether you're a believing Catholic, whether you're Muslim. I don't care. If you're a science educator, you've got to be realizing that we have to keep it secular. And what we mean by secular, of course, is the classroom is a privileged place where the students are not your pawns. They're not there to be proselytized to. So we don't go to the science classroom with the idea that we will convert them to our religion of choice or to atheism. None of those things go on in the classroom. Somebody like me, I'm a science educator, I'm a professional in the classroom, and when I go into the classroom, my job is to teach them biology, not to indoctrinate them in atheism. So this is a core principle I think that we will all agree on. Let's leave the little kids out of the battle. You know, even if you agree with me that there is a war, little kids don't belong in it. That what we need to do is just concentrate on getting them the good ideas taught in the classroom. So along these lines, you know, there's some really good news for the United States. And you can tell because I said good news, I'm later going to tell you the bad news. But there is good news, and the good news is that the science classroom is in pretty good shape as far as keeping religion out of it. That's some other problems, but we're doing a good job of keeping it up. What we've got is an incredibly strong body of case law that has done a very effective job of keeping religion out of the public school classroom. If you think about it, you know, think about the history of all these trials that have gone on, you know, from the Scopes trial to Dover. We've won them all, except the first one. Okay, we lost the Scopes trial. We got back on the technicality, although there were other problems that arose from that particular trial. But we've squashed it at every level. We've squashed it at the Supreme Court. They can't squeeze this stuff into the classroom. And I'm pretty confident in the near future that this will remain true. There are other places where people are starting to maneuver to bring up these problems. Florida and Texas come to mind. A lot of other states were having potential for challenges. But I'm pretty confident we're going to win all the court cases. Another advantage we have besides case law is we have these great organizations standing strong for keeping religion out of the classroom. And I tell everybody that you should be a member of these organizations. If you're here, you should write these down, and when you get home, Join them. Especially the first one, NCSE, National Center for Science Education. It's a great organization. All they do is focus on making sure that the science classroom is maintained as a science classroom. They offer advice to courts on what's proper to do. They do public relations. It's a really great organization. Similarly, Americans United, another great one. It doesn't focus so much on science, but on the general issue of keeping the public classrooms religion-free. And, of course, the American Civil Liberties Union. So these are all great organizations, and they have done a marvelous job. These are kind of the guardians of our classroom, and they keep the classroom secular. And they do it very well. They need your money. NCSE, it's cheap. It's like $30 a year. You should be members. I hope you all are. Anyway, this is the first hopeful piece of the story, is that the classroom is clean so far, in general. There are cases where the wall is being breached, but in general, we've got really good, solid defenders of the classroom. Now, for the bad news, though. The bad news is that we're actually losing. We are falling farther and farther behind. Just over my teaching career, I've seen increasing numbers of students coming into the college classrooms who are either poorly prepared or who are outright creationist supporters. And they aren't shy about telling it to me either. They just don't respect my authority enough. But they argue with me, and that's good. But they argue with me, but the bad thing is that they've got this load of bad information sitting in their heads. And one of the first things we have to do is to our freshmen is sort of scoop all the garbage out and try and clear the cobwebs and correct the failings of the high schools. The high schools are not doing their job. High school teachers are wonderful. I love high school teachers. They are an important force. But there are all these pressures that are operating against them. Are there any high school teachers here now? Yeah. If you talk about evolution in the classroom, maybe Madison isn't so bad, but if you talk about evolution in the classroom, you know that the people who oppose it will come in and yell at you, parents of people who oppose it. They'll come in and they'll yell at you, and they'll say they don't want you teaching their kids that garbage. On the other hand, when you teach evolution, you don't get very many of the pro-science people coming into the teacher and saying, wow, great job, we're very happy with you. It's not the way human minds work, it seems. So there's this ratchet always working to downgrade your incentive to teach good evolutionary biology. So that's happening. And what it means is that many places are just ripping their evolutionary curriculum out altogether, and students aren't getting exposed to it. Just this week, I was teaching my freshman students about evolution, teaching what Darwin had discovered. And one of the things I do is I sit down and talk with them and I ask, okay, what do you know about evolution? What did you learn about evolution in high school before you got here? And it's shocking. Over half the students weren't exposed to it. They weren't taught it at all. Then, the ones who say they did learn it, I sit down and I ask them more detailed questions about it. We try and work out, what exactly do you know about evolution? And I discovered that they know things like Punnett squares. Well, I'm glad they've got that little introduction to genetics, but that's not evolution. They haven't been taught it. They're not exposed to it. And often when you start talking with them, you find that they have terrible misconceptions about it. Every year it happens. I teach this, and I encourage students to bring up objections and talk to me about their questions. And there's always a student who will ask me, well, if we came from monkeys, how come they are still monkeys? that's the most common question I get. I get this in email all the time. Lots of people write to me. They think I'm an authority in evolution or something. I'm just a guy with a blog. But anyway, they write to me, and that's the most common question. There's a fundamental problem there. That's basic. It's basic to understanding evolution. It's about populations, populations diversifying and changing, and they haven't got it in their heads. So it's one of the jobs we have to do. Well, when you look at what's going on, I think just about everybody who talks about creationism shows this slide. It's from a couple of years ago, a paper in Science, which did an international study. They asked people in countries all around the world whether they accepted the idea of evolution or not, or whether they favored creationism. The blue bars are the good ones. Okay, the blue bars tell you how many of the respondents said yes, evolution is a fine science theory. Okay, and the red bars are the creationists, and the yellow ones are the ones who aren't certain. And actually, being uncertain is okay. I wouldn't mind if there were lots of people who are uncertain. The scary ones are the ones who are absolutely certain who have the wrong information. And this is ranking the various countries, and notice that Iceland is a great place to live. I may retire there someday. And you go down the list looking for the United States. We're not number one. We are number 33, second from the bottom. We beat Turkey, and that's it. About half the people in this country do not accept evolution. If any of you went to Ron Numbers' talk today, he would tell you the same thing. Roughly half the people in this country reject it outright. Okay, this is not so good. This is where we're losing. We're keeping the classroom nice and secure and not allowing the religion in it, but at the same time, all these students leave the classroom, they go to more influential sources like their parents, their family, their Sunday school, their church, and they're told a completely different message. And that message is much more important to them than what we teach them in the classroom. And so we come away with attitudes like this, which is frankly terrifying. I'm not sure whether we have gone past the point of no return. We may have, that we've got an increasingly less sophisticated, less well-educated population, and we're just going to slide down in the crapper and goodbye. Well, let's hope not, but we'll try. We can also look at other things, like school standards. So this is the rating of evolution treatment in state public school science standards, where what they're looking at is, you know, every state, almost every state, has a set of guidelines they give out to their teachers. They tell the teachers, okay, in seventh grade you're supposed to teach this fact in science, in eighth grade teach this, ninth, etc. And there's a long list of these. You can usually go to your state board of education, find it on the web, and read the detailed standards. Minnesota is right now revising their standards. So this is an active process where scientists and teachers and community people get together and they say, what should our kids learn? And so there we are. There's a list of what we find in various states. The red ones are unsatisfactory and useless or absent standards for evolution. This is a couple of years old, but maybe you fixed it since, I don't know. But notice Wisconsin up there. You know, if those of us from Minnesota are kind of pleased that you guys aren't quite as good. But, you know, you should be embarrassed. It says so. An embarrassment right there.
That's Illinois. Illinois.
Oh, that's Illinois. Okay. My Minnesota bias was showing through there. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're just confused. All right.
Not much better.
And Minnesota itself is only yellow. We're satisfactory good. But, you know, look at all those orange states all over the place. These are places where they're not getting exposed to evolution. All in the science standards. They're not. There is no legal recourse for parents to say, well, you were supposed to teach my students evolution in 11th grade and you didn't. Now what they've got is absolutely no leverage. And there's a trend for these science standards to be weakened over and over again. We're seeing this all over the place. This is the place where creationists can act. Okay. Here's a really horrifying one. This is another little survey where they asked a bunch of people, what do you believe? You know, like, the top one is the correct answer. That's what I tell you. Okay, human beings have developed over millions of years, but God had no part in this process. The second one down is the theistic evolution position, which I think is incorrect, but okay, some people go for it. Human beings have developed over millions of years, which is correct, but they say, okay, but God had a role in there somewhere. And then there's the scary creationist ones. God created human beings pretty much in their present form within the last 10,000 years, and no answer, no opinion, which those are the people we can just ignore. Anyway, the blue bars are just the general public. And like I said, look there, about half of them, 48%, think human beings were created in the last 10,000 years. Or as I like to say, the Earth was created 5,000 years after dogs were domesticated. So, that's not good. 13%. But what's really horrible is the red bars. Those are the science teachers. 16% of science teachers are gracious, outright young earth gracious. They're in your schools teaching your children. Are you worried yet? And this may be an underrepresentation because, you know, teachers know that when they're polled on this sort of thing, that there is an answer they are supposed to give that's different from the answer they may actually believe. I know that, you know, just going by the school district in my town, it's a small town, we've got two science teachers, and we got precisely 50% creationist and 50% creationist. Yeah, if it was 33%, you'd worry, but no, it's split. Yeah, we actually have our biology teacher at our high school is, one of them, is a creationist. And there's nothing you can do. You can't very well go in and say, you should be fired because you don't teach the right thing, but you wish you could. Yeah. Okay, so the ideal solution, of course, would be we'd be doing a better job of training this all-important task of the high school science teacher so that they all knew the correct answer and were better given this. I would be content with them answering with the second one, but that third choice, that's completely beyond the pale. Another phenomenon that we're seeing increasingly is this one. Creationists actually going through graduate programs and getting their PhD in legitimate sciences. It's sneaky and it's underhanded. But again, there's nothing you can do about it. Because if you go through a graduate program, if any of you here might be graduate students, you don't want your advisor judging whether you get your degree on the basis of irrelevant things outside your laboratory work or your research. So this is almost impossible to police against. But we've got several cases now where students have done this shocking thing, where they work through graduate programs, they get PhDs in legitimate sciences, and all along the way they are saying that they are young earth creationists. So the first one there is Marcus Ross, who recently graduated from the University of Rhode Island. He got his degree in paleontology. He was studying the distribution of mosasaurs at the Cretaceous boundary 65 million years ago. But he believes the Earth is only 6,000 years old. I don't know how they resolve this in their head, but in one direction or the other, they're lying to themselves and to the people around them. Even worse, this guy, Marcus Ross, at the same time he was going through the graduate program, was actively involved in creationism. He was going to conferences, creationist conferences, and getting up in front of audiences and pretending to be a scientist and telling them all this stuff about how those evil evolutionists are lying to you that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, and using his credentials to fake his way through. Nathaniel Abraham was an interesting case. He graduated from St. John's University. I should mention what happened to Marcus Ross. He did graduate. The only people that would hire him was Liberty University. So this may be where we catch them, is that nobody wants to hire somebody with this kind of cognitive dissonance on display. Nathaniel Abraham, as far as I know, he doesn't have a job. He graduated. He went to work for Cold Spring Harbor very briefly. He answered an ad for a person doing research on the evolution of the zebrafish, doing phylogenetic studies of molecular biology and zebrafish, and got into the lab and started working. Then he happened to mention, I'm a young earth creationist, and I really can't write papers that discuss evolution. So there again, we had a simple solution. He got fired, and he tried to file a lawsuit, and I'm pleased to say this is another case where the courts came through for us. They said, no, if you're saying you can't do the job, you can't do the job, and you get fired. So his case fell apart. He's probably now looking at Liberty University. Jonathan Wells is a particularly shocking case. Those of you who have read my blog may know that I have a great deal of personal animosity to Jonathan Wells. Jonathan Wells graduated, got his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, which I understand is a fairly prestigious university. Not quite the level of Madison, but pretty good. Okay. And he actually got his degree in my field, which is developmental biology. And he uses this all the time to do the most outrageously poor scholarship. He's written several books that he's written Icons of Evolution, which is a famous one. It's also an icon of misrepresentation. It's just a terrible, terrible book. But again, he's using these credentials that he obtained. to peddle creationism to the public, and the public doesn't know any better. Oh, this is a PhD from University of California, Berkeley. It must be something legitimate there. Of course, Jonathan Wells is also on record, he's a Mooney, and he is on record saying that he was specifically going to get his degree so that he could better destroy Darwinism at the request of his father, Sun Myung Moon. Again, what can you do? You can't retroactively remove somebody's degree. That's unethical. But there he is. He's using these credentials in horrible ways. Okay, and then of course there's politics and other ways that this is working. Aren't these people charming? I'm just curious, who knows who that sweet old couple up the top left are?
They're the tech people.
Texas.
Yeah, Mel and Norma Gabler.
Yeah.
Right. This is another one of those insidious things. We're doing a good job of keeping the problem out of the classroom, keeping the classroom secular. However, they've got other lines of attack, and one of the most common lines of attack is through the school boards. Creationists get on school boards where they have undue influence on the curriculum, on textbook selection, and so forth. Mel and Norma Gabler are among the most infamous. I think they're both dead now. I know at least one is dying. But they had a little organization in Texas that would screen school books and decide whether they were sufficiently respectful to religion, whether they were laced with Darwinism or evil things like that, and they would make recommendations to the State Board of Education and to the Senate on whether these should be approved for the classroom. Now, they had a tremendous amount of influence. They gutted a whole generation of school books. Because all the publishers knew that if they had a book that was very strong in evolution, it gave the strong evidence for evolution, Mel and Norma Gabler would be sitting there in their kitchen, going over it and making little notes about how this is evil and wretched and nasty, and they would go to the Senate and they would say, no, you can't use this book. And the publishers would have to go back and edit them out and edit out all the good stuff. So they had amazing influence for many years. The fellow next to them over there in the middle, that's, who knows that guy? Yeah.
Ray Comfort.
No.
Hugh Ross.
No, this is somebody even more dangerous. This is Don McLeroy, who you may not have heard of. Don McLeroy is, now you've heard of him, yeah. Don McLeroy is a dentist. He may be a very good dentist. But he also believes the earth is 6,000 years old, et cetera, the usual litany of creation of dogma. And he's very loud about this, and he's very, very opinionated, and he's very influential. And for speaking out against science, he has been rewarded with the position of the president of the State Board of Education of Texas. Think about that. That's the guy who's controlling policy of one of the largest school boards in the country. And he has flat out said he believes we ought to be including more Jesus in the classroom, that we ought to be including more creationism. We ought to be teaching both at the very least. So that's another level of attack. School boards, they're hitting us hard there. The guy on the far right, who is, he really looks like a missing link, doesn't he? that is Ken Ham. Who you may also have heard of, he's the guy who started the Creation Museum in Kentucky. Ron Numbers mentioned him in his talk this afternoon. And, he's really the powerhouse behind creationism in this country right now. He's got money. He's got the biggest organization. He's got all kinds of money going there. He can build that $27 million museum. He's got a site called Answers in Genesis, which I often go to if I need a laugh. It's just the most amazing, outrageous claims. But that's huge amounts of money there. This is a wealthy man, a very influential man, and he comes flat out and says, Earth is 6,000 years old. If you learn about evolution, you'll go out and rape somebody. That's his line. Okay, Discovery Institute. I tend to kind of downplay the Discovery Institute nowadays. The Discovery Institute has shot its wad and it's failed. The Discovery Institute is sort of a front for creationism, which proposes to pretend to be a scientific organization, pretends to be entirely secular, and it's arguing for a intelligent designer of some unnamed nature that has done something which they won't specify in the history of Earth's life. And their main business is sending out press releases. They write lots of press releases. You may have seen them in your local paper. People still publish them, and they're out there. That last person, I just throw there because she's cute. We would never consider electing this person to a highest office of land, would we? She's a member of the Assembly of God Church. She's believes that we are in the end times, that the world is going to end soon. There's a whole bunch of prophecies about this, that, you know, that, for instance, Russia is going to send a bunch of nuclear missiles over to Israel. And if you read the Left Behind books, you get the whole story. She believes that's literally true, and she's going to be possibly influencing international diplomatic policy for our country. Oh, well, what can you say? Okay, so we got these problems. What is the root of our problem? What do you think I will say the answer is to this question? Oh, religion, somebody said. Yes, you're being tight. Well, yeah, this is the source of the problem, that that we have given an unwarranted deference to religion in this country. All you have to do is say, God told me so, and suddenly it becomes very difficult to question the assertion of a person saying so. That we've suddenly lost the ability to criticize people who are saying absolutely foolish things, who are saying that the earth is 6,000 years old, against all evidence, but because it's part of their religion, it suddenly becomes something that cannot be questioned. That you are violating their rights. You are offending them deeply just by bringing up the question. Well, also, this is also not a good situation. All of us with a scientific bent are well aware that skepticism is the heart of science. That you've got to ask questions about everything. That even something that we hold as obviously true, something like evolution, is constantly being subject to test and criticism. That's the way we work. It's exactly the opposite of the way religion runs. Religion says, okay, we've got an assertion, we make this assertion, and by the weight of the authority that has made that assertion, you are not allowed to question it any further. You can elaborate on it, but no, you cannot question it. So that's a fundamental problem, and it's clearly influencing a lot of people who have this kind of arrogant sense of privilege that all they have to do is say, well, God is going to do this, and therefore you can't argue with me. Okay, so here's why I would say that religion and science are in conflict. There's a couple of things that bring them into conflict, and one is a very simple one. They're competing ways of knowing. You know, science is not simply a body of facts, right? Science is a procedure. It's a process. It's a set of tools, set of intellectual, logical, empirical tools that we use to arrive at some approximation to a truth, where we constantly test our ideas. Religion is revelatory. It's saying really that truth comes out of tradition, comes out of holy books, comes out of, in some cases, the protestations of prophets, that they say this is how the way the world works. These are in conflict. Like I said, it's hard to argue against somebody who says, God has told me that I must do this. Because there's no rational argument you can make. It completely strips scientists of the tools required to address the particular issue. I would also say that another problem is this one, that religion is epistemically empty and unverifiable. When students come into my freshman class, the first lecture I give them is I talk about the scientific method, and I always give my students the secret to success, the thing that will make them look brilliant in all of their classes. And they really appreciate this, and I know they pulled it on me several times now. I tell them there's one great question that you can always ask. You just raise your hand in the middle of any lecture and ask the professor, how do you know that? How do you know that is the heart of science, is being able to figure out how we understand something. and a good professor will be able to explain how we know this, what kind of evidence was applied to reach this. So that's what we mean by an epistemic process. We've got a way to talk about how we know things. Religion, no, you can't do that. You know, if you raise your hand in church, well, you know, first of all, they're not going to call on you in church, right? It's against the rules. But if you did, and if you're persistent, you know, jumped up and down and asked the pastor, okay, how do you know that? What are they going to tell you? They're going to tell you the Bible says so. They're going to say that they had an equivalent of a dream, and the dream said this was the case. Or do they just know it? And none of those are good answers in science. You know, if a student asked me how I knew something about cell biology worked, and I said, oh, well, I had a dream about it last night. It was happening in the classroom. It just would not work. Okay, and the last big reason, religion is ridiculous. Come on. Have you listened to the stories they tell you? right there at the heart of Christianity, original sin. Think about that. You're in trouble, you're a sinner, you're evil, because your great, 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 many times great grandmother listened to a talking snake and ate an apple. And this is reflecting on your life now, and this has given God cause to cause you any kind of suffering he feels like, because you're bad. But of course, God is love, so he fixed this by becoming human and getting killed. Only he wasn't really killed. He came back, he was alive again. And somehow, this erased all the sin. I don't understand this. This is illogical, okay? It's kind of a ridiculous story. And we won't even get into stuff about miracles. I have got a lot of mail lately about transubstantiation. How they believe this, I do not understand. Okay, so religion is ridiculous. It sounds like I got a friendly audience that agrees with me. If you disagree, that's okay. You can try and convince me otherwise, and we'll all have a great laugh. But it's ridiculous, but it's still very popular. Why is it so popular? And I would argue that, you know, what makes it popular is a couple of things. Is tradition, right? We value tradition. I like tradition. I like putting up a Christmas tree every year. I did it when I was a kid. I did it with my kids. Yeah, it's kind of cool to have these sustained traditions that you know your grandparents and your great-grandparents went through, and you can feel that connection with your family. So that's one of the strengths of religion, is attached right into our value of things like family and history and tradition. Another reason it's popular is fear. This is the thing I think is the most powerful factor in the acceptance of religion, is they tell you that if you don't believe my religion, you are going to suffer forever. Horrible torments for eternity. And again, I've got lots of email lately that tells me in detail all these horrible things are really happening. So there's this social influence. It's saying, you've got to go along with this or horrible things will happen to you. And if you don't believe me, I'm going to make sure that they happen to you sooner. And another one is tribalism. Why do we accept religion? It's for the same reason we accept patriotism. Like, you know, that we are a group of people. We have these commonalities that make us feel good, to be able to associate with our fellow human beings, get together with them, meet with them. You know, things like the atheist group here. That's a little bit of us versus them. It's saying we are a group, we have these common ideals, and we'll support them. So religion has these factors that favor it. Another one is, I'm going to show you a little cartoon here. It's a cute cartoon. This gets right to the heart of my main question, that is the fundamental question that I'm interested in is things like, where did we come from? And so this little cartoon, it's showing two guys sitting on rocks, and nice stick figure art, right? And this is a common question. Where did people come from? How did we get to be here? And it's natural for all of us to wonder about this. And we want to provide answers. Now, if you're a smart aleck scientist, you provide an answer like this, right? We get lots of details. We start talking about molecules, we talk about cells, we talk about protists, we start evolving into metazoans, and the metazoans became little fishy things that swam around, you know, little vertebrates. And the vertebrates evolved into tetrapods that crawled out of the land, populated the land, became things like reptiles. Reptiles become mammals. Mammals become primates, and primates, there we are. Okay. And it's a good story. It's a really powerful story. It's particularly powerful because we can provide all kinds of evidence for this. Unfortunately, it takes hard work to learn this evidence, and they don't teach it in Sunday school. So you have to get it somewhere, and hopefully you get it in your college education or in your personal reading. But it's a fairly complicated story. I find it an extremely satisfying story, but you know, some people may not. And some people may just look at this in shock and say, well, what? I didn't come from no monkey. That's a very common feeling. There's some idea that it's insulting to be descended from worms, when worms are really wonderful animals that you ought to appreciate more. Well, so they may ask these questions, and they'll of course have their own explanation. And that is, there was a big, powerful magic man in the sky. Now, that may sound, you know, to a bunch of atheists, that sounds, oh, that's loony. But it actually makes a lot of sense. You know, that if you're used to thinking in human terms are all about agency, how people do things, how actions are carried out by individuals. And so it's kind of natural to say, well, okay, maybe there was a super powerful individual who acted to do all this stuff. And, of course, by unspecified means, usually involving lightning bolts or mud or something, he created you. Now, this is very appealing, too. This appeals to our ego. The most powerful being in the universe, personally, conjured me into existence. I must be really special, right? No worms in my ancestry, just Superman in the sky. And that's satisfying. And it's also satisfying because you can do things like talk back to him. You can say, okay, this is very nice, but there's a list of demands I have. You haven't satisfied my every desire. And of course, God will then satisfy your every desire. This is appealing too, this kind of wish fulfillment idea. So all of these things are conspiring to make you feel really good. And then of course, yeah, you just imagine, well, there's the two of us. Look, they're smiling. They're very happy. This is sort of a happy story, much better than those fishes and protists and molecules and stuff. And of course, then the converse happens. We godless scientists are listening to this ridiculous story, and we got a laugh. And there's a standard response. Everybody's laughing and competing. So, what happens? Well, you know. There we go. And of course, this is especially satisfying because, you know, God's giving you a thumbs up for this. So you've not only accomplished something, you know, squelched your opposition, but God is going to reward you now with eternity in somewhere. Okay, so I've made a case. The religion's a problem. It's a set of ridiculous beliefs. I think it interferes with the proper teaching of science. In particular, it interferes with the proper understanding of the scientific method by the population at large. So the question, of course, is what are we going to do about it? Now, I've talked about this to lots of people, and I've gotten these amazing assumptions from people who think they read my blog, and they've actually said, P.Z. Myers is planning to load all the religious people onto cattle cars and gas them. There's actually a comment on the web just like this. It says, yeah, this is my grand plan. When nothing is further from the truth, I don't want to do anything about individuals. I don't want to harm anyone. My sister teaches Sunday school, and I like my sister, okay? So no, she's not going into a cattle car, and if you try to put her there, I will fight you. But the question is, what are we going to do about this? And I was recently interviewed in a very popular documentary about and I won't go into the details. They've been hashed everywhere. But yeah, I was in this this strange documentary that was purporting to say that, that we evil scientists were conspiring to throw all the godless, all the godly people out of the universities and so forth. And I was interviewed, and one of the things they asked is what's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen? And I actually provided an answer there that I thought was a pretty good answer. So I'm just going to play it for you. So I've got a little clip I'll play, and I'll just mention, this is the only part of the movie I have actually seen. Everyone tells me that, that the part with me in it is the best part of the whole movie. It's okay, but I don't know if I'll ever see the rest. Anyway, so just let me play this short clip, and it's me and Richard Dawkins, and we're talking to these guys about what we think is going to happen.
Biologist P.Z. Myers, who runs the pro-Darwin anti-religion lodge for Ringula, says science erodes his faith as well.
I never hated religion. I found religion quite comfortable now. What led to atheism was learning more about science, learning more about the natural world, and seeing these horrible conflicts with religion.
And it was then, when I discovered evolution, when I discovered Darwinism, that I realized that this magnificently elegant, stunningly elegant explanation, which I didn't quite understand to begin with. When I did understand it, then that finally killed off my remaining religious faith.
Religion is an idea that gives some people comfort, and we don't want to take it away from them. It's like knitting. People like to knit. But if you take knitting is away, we're not going to take away their churches. But what we have to do is get it to a place where religion is treated at the level it should be treated. That is something fun that people get together and do on the weekend, and really doesn't affect their life as much as it has been so far.
So, what would the world look like if Dr. Myers got his wish?
Greater science literacy, which is going to lead to the erosion of religion. And then we'll get this nice positive feedback mechanism around, where as religion slowly fades away, we get more and more science to replace it. And that will displace more and more religion, which will allow more and more science in. And we'll eventually get to that point where religion has taken that appropriate place as a side dish rather than the main course. And if you separate out the ethical message from religion, what do you get left? You get a bunch of fairy tales, right?
I think that God is about as unlikely as fairies, angels, hobgoblins, etc.
Religion, I mean, it's just fantasy, basically. It's completely empty of any explanatory content. And it's evil as well.
Okay, keep in mind, they interviewed me for 3 hours, and this was the most horrible thing they were able to extract from my interview. About a minute was about me comparing it to knitting. And I understand that when it's been shown in theaters, again, I haven't been in any theater with it, people gasp in horror at me making this comparison, which I don't understand. I thought it was pretty nice. Although I will admit that afterwards I received a lot of hate mail from knitters. So I've really been grasping it. I thought, knitting is not the right thing to compare it to. So for a while I was trying bowling, and then I realized bowlers tend to be kind of burly. And no, you don't want to piss off the bowlers. So I've got a new comparison. I say that the way we want to see religion is we want religion to achieve the status of masturbation. Now, seriously, there's nothing wrong with masturbation. And it may even have positive health benefits. It makes people feel good. And so, you know, we're not going to legislate against masturbation. But on the other hand, if you think about it, we'd rather not have public exhibitions. And particularly, we don't want someone's enthusiasm for the activity to be a primary qualification for being president of the United States. that's kind of where we want to put it. And I think I can make that one safely without getting lots of hate mail from chronic masturbation. Okay, so anyway, you know, that little clip, I see myself being embarrassingly idealistic, that what I'm hoping is that literacy and education will lead to an erosion of the fanaticism of religion, and that it will acquire its proper place as something, a pleasant hobby for some people, something that they may sincerely believe, but they're not willing to really force anyone else to do it. Like, nobody will come at you with a pair of knitting needles and say, take these, you must make me a scarf. You know, that doesn't happen. And we don't want that to happen with religion, right? Especially, I don't want them coming to us and telling us we must masturbate. Okay, so what are we going to do? Well, what I think we need to do is, like I said, classroom needs to be left alone. Let's keep that secular. Let's not do this in the classroom. But I think outside the classroom, all of you here, we need to start being more assertive. We have to be more aggressive. It's not enough for us to sit back and say, well, okay, you believe what you believe, I believe what I believe. No, we have to get out there and we have to point out that a lot of these religious beliefs are damaging and ridiculous, and we need to do it 10 years ago. So get started. What kinds of things can you do? Well, first of all, let me clear up one problem. Everybody says, well, we don't want to do this because we don't want to make them angry or upset with us. And I'm so used to the whiny atheist who just hates the fact that I'm sometimes a teeny tiny bit obnoxious. You have to be a little bit obnoxious, and it doesn't matter that maybe you think you should be polite to people, because no matter what you do, they're not going to like you. Okay, if you don't buy into their dogma, you have already pissed them off. That's one of the defining characteristics of fervent religions, is everybody has to believe what they believe, or you're bad, you're going to hell, you're destroying society. So, you know, there's no incentive to be a moderate here. Go ahead, cut loose. Tell them what you think, what you really think, like I do, all the time. So that's one thing I'm telling you, is don't be shy about it. Get out there and say what you really think. You know, this doesn't mean you go to your elderly grandmother and scream in her ear or something. You know what I'm saying? That, you know, your elderly grandmother is an intelligent adult, and you can have a polite discussion with them. Break the news to them that you're an agnostic, you're an atheist. And I bet you a lot of you have grandmothers who will kind of, their hair will jump out like this and they'll be a little bit frightened. But if you talk with them, you know, they love you. They'll eventually accommodate. They'll eventually learn. Especially if all of their kids are coming to them, breaking this home. And so that's what we need, is we need a little bit of motivation, a little incentive. So we're just telling everybody, come out. And many of you may have heard of this, the Out campaign that Richard Dawkins started. If you go to this thing, it's just a little thing that says, you know, come out, wear the t-shirt. There, see, like that. He's come out, he's wearing his t-shirt. Yeah. Okay. This is a very mild thing, right? It's not going up to some Christian and slapping. It's not blowing up churches. Just let it be known that no, you don't believe, and that you're going to stand up for your disbelief, that you're not going to accept this kind of thing. The other thing is ask awkward, uncomfortable questions. Okay. I really like this. This was used by an Ohio Community College atheist group. They made a sign, and they put it up in the student union and said, okay, did Jesus Christ have a homosexual relationship? With this picture of these really hunky, hot men. Of course people were noticing this. They were asking questions. And that's good. You know, you don't have to believe in Jesus. You don't have to believe he was gay. I figure there probably was a real Jesus, and I really doubt that in a repressive ancient culture like that he could be openly gay. So, you know, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but still, ask the question, make people think about it. And, you know, this particular one does double duty, because it makes them think, you know, is homosexuality really that bad? Is this saying something bad about Jesus, to say he might have been homosexual? A lot of people thought so. They had to pull the sign down after only one day, because all these people were coming up in shock and saying, oh no, my children might see this and they'd be horrified to learn that men are good looking and sometimes men like each other. This, and so they had to move. But it starts the questions flowing. And I think that's another important value that atheists can bring to society, is they can question dogma. Now again, we're not going to convert everybody. We can't. We're not even trying that hard. But we can make people think and ask questions about their own beliefs. And we find often that when people start asking questions about their beliefs, that leads them to join the atheist group eventually. Okay, another one that's fun. No, this is all hard work. Sometimes you can have a lot of fun with this. And I tell everybody, go out and blaspheme. It's a victimless crime. It's always good to get a rise out of people. And you know, if your inbox and your email program is a little empty, I can tell you from experience, you'll get lots of friends, right? This is the blasphemy challenge that Brian Fleming started. And what he said is that, you know, when he was a kid in a religious school, he was told that the most horrible thing you could ever do is deny the Holy Spirit. And there's actually a line in the Bible that says, this is the one unforgivable sin, is to deny the Holy Spirit, whatever that means. I don't know what it means. So he said, okay, I deny the Holy Spirit. And he said, why don't you deny the Holy Spirit too, and why don't you film it and put it on YouTube? And so thousands and thousands of people did this. So if you go to YouTube, you'll find a lot of very silly and embarrassing and sometimes profound, but more often silly, YouTube videos of people just getting on saying, yeah, I deny the Holy Spirit. I'm going to hell, ha-ha. You know, like they're going to Disneyland or something. But that's good. You know, we don't really believe that you're going to hell. But it's another one of these tools that allows you to start asking questions. And, you know, it's been kind of interesting that the aftermath of this is that now there's still a few people out there who say, yeah, you're going to hell. But, no, there's a lot of people out there saying, well, you know, maybe it doesn't really mean that it's this kind of trivial, silly thing, and God wouldn't really send you to hell for just saying, I don't believe in the Holy Spirit. Which is progress, okay? We've made a little room for ourselves. We can now say, I deny the Holy Spirit without having to worry about going to hell. Okay, so do this. Just think of things, you know, just blaspheme every once in a while. It's okay. Okay, in a related incident, you may have heard of this one. Webster Cook and Benjamin Pollard, they did this dreadful thing, sort of. Webster Cook, I've talked to him a few times now, and I don't think he's a fervent atheist of any kind. He's a secular person, all right. And he's mainly a conservative student. He's much more conservative than I am, which makes me very uncomfortable. Anyway, he was just simply concerned about the fact that the University of Central Florida was using student fees to fund Catholic masses in the student union. And he thought this was an improper use of student funds. And he went, he's a Catholic, he has a right to do this, he went through mass. And he essentially walked out of the mass with the communion wafer and was assaulted for it. Very fervent people rushed to him and grappled with him and said, you can't get away with this, and you can't leave the room with this. And of course, because he's a libertarian sort of person, he said, of course I can, and he did. So he left with his cracker. he put it in a baggie, apparently, and kept it in his dorm room for a whole week before he returned it. But that would have ended there, right? The Catholic Church was kind of upset. He was not against the Catholic Church. He returned it after a week because he got tired of the death threats. And but the thing is, Bill Donahue of the Catholic League blew this all out of proportion. That Bill Donahue essentially said that he was holding the body of Christ hostage. And I've since learned from the many emails that I've received that, yes, he was actually holding Jesus hostage, that Jesus was in the baggie. He's saying it's beyond hate speech that this student ought to be expelled. And he was calling for the expulsion of a student on the basis of this. Well, you know, I'm a liberal faculty at a liberal arts university, so of course I was upset, so I wrote something too. And I said, okay, somebody score me some communion crackers quick, because I'll do something far worse than Webster Cook would ever do. And so I put this up there, and boy, that this really set Bill Donahue off. I kind of expected that, sure, a few people would be angry, it would be a symbolic gesture in support of Webster Cook, okay? That's all I thought it was going to be. But then Bill Donahue quickly comes back, and he says it's very hard to think of anything more violent than potentially desecrate the body of Christ. And, Bill Donahue obviously has a very limited imagination. Because I read that and I started imagining all kinds of vile things, right? Knocking over a bank, I think would probably be more vile than destroying a cracker. Actually, I tend not to think in terms of knocking over banks, so I was thinking, what I could really do that would be evil is I could get a nice oatmeal raisin cookie and throw it in the garbage disposal. Now that's worse than one of these horrible little crackers. But anyway, here he is. He's saying there's nothing more vile than what I was threatening to do. And I thought, this is kind of the end of it. There's not much more that Bill Donahue can do. But there was. I live in Minnesota. The Republican National Convention was in Minnesota. And Bill Donahue put out an alert for increased security at the Republican National Convention to protect them from me. Now, my wife will tell you that I might have a little bit of an ego now and then, but this really inflated it beyond all that. I've really got to go to St. Paul and stroll the streets with a box of crackers. Just to show how badass I really am. And I heard that they actually did increase security. They hired a couple of extra security guards. But I actually didn't go, so it was... And then, of course, what do? They put out a call for me to be fired. That they called the president, the Board of Regents, the Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action Office, Minnesota's governor, both houses of the state legislature, the Catholic community. I'm not sure how they contact the whole Catholic community. And then the kicker is that last one. Moreover, we are also contacting the Muslim community. This was a constant theme in the letters people were sending me, is we Catholics are so nice that we wouldn't do anything like chop your heads off like the Muslims would. So we're telling the Muslims to go chop your heads off. What can you do? Fortunately, my university has a strong commitment to academic freedom and recognize the fact that I was threatening a cracker. Come on. if I were planning to desecrate Catholic student, yes. But I like my students, whether they're Catholic or not, so that wasn't an issue. Okay, well, now I was left with a dilemma. All these people were sending me crackers, lots of crackers. And I really didn't have a plan. What are you going to do? So I started digging around. I read a couple of books on host desecration. It's actually a chilling story. People have done this. They have written books on host desecration. One of the recent ones is if you read Constantine's Sword by James Carroll. It's a very Catholic book. The author is extremely Catholic, and he reminds you every page that he's Catholic. And he's talking about the history of the Catholic Church and anti-Semitism. This is a big issue that you can find lots of medieval histories to talk about this. That in the 13th century, the Catholic Church decided that those rascally Jews really wanted to get our communion crackers, which have intense magical powers, and the Jews were dreaming of stealing crackers so that they could pound nails through them and, first of all, torture Jesus again, and secondly, extract blood from the crackers that they can then use in their heathen Jewish rites. So let me ask, is anyone here Jewish? Have you dreamed of desecrating? Yeah, it's not part of any Jewish ritual I ever heard to obtain Catholic relics and do anything. they have no interest at all in doing this. Seriously, no, it's just an imaginary crime that they were committing. But of course, they have all these because this is a picture of a gang of Jews who've got their crackers and their nails, and they're pounding through the nails, and they're bleeding, and they're going to use them in these horrible heathen rites and so forth. And it sounds absolutely absurd. It sounds really funny until you realize that in the 13th century and on, that they were using this as a pretext to go into Jewish communities and murder everyone. Literally. Kill every human being in the Jewish community. Men, women, children. Preferably by torture. You know, tie them up on a stake and set them on fire. This is real. This happened in history. That host desecration isn't just funny business. That it was a pretext for doing some of the most incredibly evil, vile things that human beings could do to other human beings. So, of course, after reading this, I have to pound a nail through my crackers, right? That not only was I going to be protesting what was done to Webster Cook, but I was going to be protesting the whole Catholic tradition of using this to visit unimaginable horrors on people. Now, of course, you got to know, Catholic Church has done better, right? They haven't done this in a while. The last person they burned for the imaginary crime of desecrating a host was 130 years ago. So I felt pretty safe, mostly. So anyway, it was kind of a anti-climax, right? I just put a nail through the cracker and threw it in the trash. And just to be fair, I also tore up a Koran and a copy of my holy book, The God Delusion. No, it's such a trivial thing. This is not a matter of consequence, and I didn't want it to be. I don't want people to think this is significant. The whole point is that it is so incredibly trivial that it's destroying a piece of bread. We do this all the time. There was no manifestation of Jesus. There was no unholy scream of ouch from the heavens. Nothing. He was just throwing away a piece of bread in a symbolic way. But of course, this also blew up. I got some of the most amazing mail out of this. At last count, I have received between 16,000 and 18,000 pieces of email from outraged people. And I've received over 1,000 letters, you know, real, live, paper letters. It's very quaint. They come in the mail. And they inundated my university president's office with these letters, and I haven't yet had the nerve to sit down and have a conversation with them and find out what it was like. But I can sort of imagine. But you know, here's one example, and you know, this is a fairly typical letter. It's the most despicable act he's ever witnessed. Your act is far more deplorable than Hitler's Holocaust or the terrorists on 9/11.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Think about that. You know, I argue that religion is bad because it's an invalid way of knowing. It's an invalid way of understanding the world. But, you know, what was brought home to me by these letters is that religion is also promoting a moral vacuum. That, you know, this is possibly one of the most immoral, amoral, horrible things people have ever said. That destroying a cracker is worse than killing 6 million Jews. You've got to wonder, what would this person do to protect his cracker? I mean, we've already got the lower bound. He's willing to kill 6 million Jews to protect him. But where's the upper bound? And there doesn't seem to be one. That this has become an immoral principle. That believing in a God, an imaginary God, with a set of rules that are just made up as you go along, is shortcutting moral philosophy. It's destroying people's ability to judge what is right and wrong. And so this is another reason that I'm opposed to religion. I could list many other reasons, but that's one good reason. And of course, there's always this nice Christian sentiment that I'm going to be suffering for eternity in horrible ways. Some of these letters really go into great detail on my torments, which is always fun to read. I do not pass these on to my wife, that's for sure. Okay, let me wrap this up. I'm going too long. So let me just say one last thing. So here's our situation, that we have a good, sound, secure school system that is being gutted from beneath, that we're seeing our teachers losing their authority, they're losing their ability to teach properly. And we've got to engage this broader culture war. We've got to go on the warpath here. We've got to strike out, not in any kind of violent way, of course, but with argument, with open discussion, with assertion of our ideas. And we've got to fight back against religion. And this is always causing some problems with my fellow educators, because many educators will say, well, of course we can't do this, because if you criticize people's religion, they just shut down, they won't listen to you when you try and teach them about science. And I just like to point out that that's the strategy we've been following for the last 100 years or more, and we're losing. It's not working. And we've got to do something different. We've got to shake them up. Anyway, there's this wonderful discussion between Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins that you can find at the Scientific American site. And it's really good, because I like both of these people. These are brilliant people. They're both on my side, maybe not in detail, but in general. And we agree on just about everything. And Lawrence Krauss just brought up this interesting point that is often brought up to me, and it's part and bold there. I wonder which is more important, using the contrast between science and religion to teach about science, or trying to put religion in its place. And this is the problem we militant atheists often have, is that we're confronted with. They're told, well, obviously you think defeating religion is more important than doing a good job teaching science, which I find extremely objectionable. I don't agree with that at all, because I think they're both the same. That we have to teach science, but we also have to teach them about bad ideas, and we have to get those bad ideas out of their heads somehow. So I think Lawrence Krauss is making a good point here. I agree that this is a bit of a problem for us. Sometimes I am obnoxious. I know this. But he's also pointing out that the validity of this, if you look down farther, that, okay, he's telling you, teaching is seduction, and that's true. But also, telling people that their deepest beliefs are simply silly may defeat subsequent pedagogy. However, if the primary purpose in discussing the subject is to put religion in its proper context, then it perhaps is useful to shock people into questioning their beliefs. And I would say that's an important part of teaching science, is getting them into that point of view where they question everything. And so I would disagree with Lawrence Krauss here. I would say that these are not mutually contradictory values, that we have to do both. I will keep the classroom secular. I will not expose students to horrible atheist ideas there, because I've got a job to do, and that's the pedagogy part. Let's seduce them into thinking about science properly. But at the same time, outside the classroom, I think I have a responsibility as a public intellectual, as somebody representing academic freedom, to do something to shake the boat every once in a while, that we need to do this business of alerting people to the absurdity of some of the beliefs that are being promoted in our country right now. Okay, I will leave it right there for questions, and I will also mention we're going to the
Union Terrace.
Mm-hmm. After you guys are done grilling me for beers, so if anybody wants to join us then. But questions, fire away. No questions. Oh, go ahead.
Since you're saying that as a public figure, you go out and you say things against religion to get people to think, has it been your experience with your blog or going out with these lectures that you actually have caused people to move from their religious belief towards a more
Definitely. Secular
view?
Yes, I collect testimonials, and I've got lots of letters from people who said that they have actually moved from religious dogma to, at least agnosticism, and that they appreciate the fact that I'm actually forcing them to think and question. And then, of course, there's a few that say that now I've convinced them that they must be more fervent in their belief in Jesus Christ, but it all comes to that. So yeah, it works for some, maybe not for all. But for some. No, I do not have the universal panacea here. I do not have a magic recipe. All I've got is one of many strategies that I think some of us have to implement. And, of course, other people will implement the other strategies, the more conciliatory strategies. So I think we'll have the whole spectrum covered, which is what we want to do. Back there.
Thank you. This week on your blog, you posted an entry on, I think, a creationist front group called Common Sense Science.
The physicists.
Yeah, whatever that. I'm not a scientist myself, so I had some problem wrestling with the ideas presented on the website. One of the things, the question is a pedagogical and a rhetorical question. And I'm wondering, as a teacher and as somebody, I myself have struggled with these ideas, and that, insofar as they're complicated, they're complex ideas. Richard Dawkins said himself that he had problems understanding these.
Yeah.
It strikes me that common sense, this idea of common sense in this title, that people assume that the only way that an idea can be true is if it's easy.
Right.
And pedagogically and rhetorically, how do we bring people, our students, friends and family members, to be able to attend to difficult ideas without initially being able to understand them?
Right. It's something that ought to begin in the grade. Is students ought to be brought up to question things and to pursue them a little deeper. I can say that I tried various exercises in my classroom. For instance, one thing I've done is I have a set of websites that I send my students off to read and to evaluate. And they're everything from legitimate sites, like the University of California, Berkeley, it's a wonderful evolution site that I send them to look at, send them to Answers in Genesis. A really fun one, have you seen Zepetopee.net, the Pacific Northwest tree octopus? It's a complete spoof site, yeah. And it's great fun, and you send them there and you say, is a Pacific tree octopus real? You know, climbing trees and you look at paper. And it's a good idea. You just drill this into them that you don't accept anything at face value. You dig deeper. And we talk about little rules that you can use to figure out if it's valid or not. Like you look at the sources, are they credible sources? Do they say contradictory things? In that common sense site, I mentioned one clear rubric. If you're looking at a physics site and they don't use any math, there's a problem.
Well, I think that was one of the problems, right, was that somehow it became physics had moved away from real physical models and it was...
Yes, they actually arguing that math is bad.
Right.
Again, that whole business of making the people feel good, you don't need math to be a quantum physicist. No. it's practice. It's just getting people used to questioning everything. And that goes for the valid sites, too. I want my students to question places like NCSE, like Berkeley. Look at those sites and try and determine how you would figure out whether they were actually telling you the truth or not. What would you compare it to? What would you research? How would you figure it out? Yeah.
One thing that people like Dawkins are criticized for a lot is that if they actually convince people that that evolution leads to atheism, that there's no way we can get it into schools after that. So for those of us who aren't willing to stay silent about that,
Well, like I said, classroom has to remain secular. And that means you don't go to the classroom and tell them if you believe this, you're a good atheist. That just doesn't work. I think that, I've actually talked to some of the church people in the town. I know this surprises everyone, but I've actually gone to the conservative church in my town, the far right wing, very crazy conservative church in my town. I have a good relationship with the pastor there. I've talked to the youth pastor. We have coffee together down there. They've got concerns. Creationists are just like us. They have the same values that we have in that they want their children to grow up healthy and happy. And if you sincerely believe that here's one way for your child to live forever in paradise, you'd be crazy not to be pushing it, right? What I've told him, we had this conversation once, and he was very upset with me because he said, you send these kids off to the college, and they get indoctrinated in Darwinism, and they come to question their religious beliefs, and then they fall away from the church, and that's why we can't send our kids to your classroom. And the example I use is I tell them, okay, well, imagine that you spend your Sunday school telling all the children that the sky is green, and then you tell them you can't look, but it's green. And then you send them off to college, and we don't declare their beliefs are wrong. What we do instead is tell them to open their eyes and look up. Are we at fault? Have we indoctrinated them into atheism? Have we led them away from the church? I would say no, we haven't. That the fault lies with the religious beliefs. That what they need to do is they're the ones who need to make an accommodation of their beliefs to reality. Like I said, I don't imagine us ever destroying religion. What I would like to see is that religion evolve into a less pathological form, where people can go to church and at the same time they recognize that there is a real world outside the church that operates on natural principles. And by enforcing that idea, let's think about natural law. Let's think how the world really works. We're calling their beliefs indirectly into doubt. But you can't blame us for it. I believe in crazy things. Yeah.
You come at it from an educator's point of view, and you're very nonchalant about what you're doing, but I have an incredible amount of admiration for you and respect for you, because thousands of letters and no doubt hundreds of death threats put you face-to-face with the reason we don't all stand up to do this in an extreme example. Was this a conscious choice of yours to move into a realm where you put your personal safety at risk?
Well, a true confession, I'm a coward. You know, I don't want to die. I want to live. I'm an atheist. There's nothing waiting for me. But what it really is that I have a fundamental optimism about people. And I really don't believe that even these people who are writing these explicit discussions about how they're going to stab me through the heart and so forth, they don't really plan on doing it. Okay? That creationists and religious people at heart are decent human beings who may get outraged about violations of their what they consider sacred, but you know, deep down, I don't think they're going to hurt me. I think they're going to be angry at me. They're going to write angry letters. But the time for burning at the stake is over. This is largely a secular nation. I mean, we'll move beyond that. I think we're safe, mostly. And I think we'd be even more safe if all of you would join me in being equally outrageous. Because that would spread the blame. Greater number of targets. Yeah, I'm being very selfish in what I'm telling you to do here.
Two shameless plugs. Everybody really do support the National Center for Science Education. I actually worked there for 3 years myself. And Jeannie Scott and Glenn Branch there, without a lot of, you know, getting a lot of credit for the work they do, work day in and day out, going toe-to-toe with creationists, and I can tell you, it sucks. I did it for 3 years, and it was so burned out, I had to leave. Also, our Americans United chapter has been reformed here in Wisconsin, and we're going to be down at the Willie Street Fair tomorrow. So if you get a chance, stop by our table and pick up some stuff and, you know, sign up for our email alerts. That chapter here in Wisconsin is really getting into full gear and doing a lot of cool stuff. But my question is, it's been interesting to see this sort of, I don't know what you call it, this kind of like, you know, like a coming out party or something in the last few years. And a lot of people attribute it to 9/11, saying that people have taken a more critical look at religion, which But I'm wondering what you would see, you know, there is this, you know, this what everybody's calling the in-your-face atheism just recently. A lot of, every time people tell me, you know, well, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual, I give them the Humanist Manifesto, and I see, read this, and then the next step, they're going, okay, I don't believe in God, you know. So it is a lot like coming out. You know,
yes.
What would you attribute this surge to?
Oh, well, I would say that, I would blame it on the Republican Party. Okay. A lot of it is a reaction to the overt religiosity that we're seeing in politics right now, especially in the United States, that we're beginning to see the consequences of letting priests rule the country. It's a frightening thing to see. That's part of it. But and I would also blame or credit creationism that since the Scopes Trial in 1925, we have been building a greater and greater number of militant scientists and That's a weird combination of words, right? Militant scientists. We don't really picture these sorts of things. But yeah, when you see your livelihood, when you see your interest, when you see the love of your life being constantly attacked by people who, they're inbred morons, you know, and you kind of get pissed off about it. And it's just been a growing thing where, people like Richard Dawkins have of course been facing this constantly throughout their careers. And I think it's all just driving us to a greater and greater militancy. And then also, of course, it's just this. If you read the scientific literature right now in evolutionary biology, this is a renaissance of evolution right now. We are learning the most amazing things about these molecular techniques. I am so happy to be alive right now because this is the sort of miracle century we're seeing right now in biology.
By the way, did you see just today Nick Matzke set a post around the stuff that he did on the bacterial flagellum to knock down BE?
Mm-hmm.
If you could comment on that, that's really amazing.
I haven't had a chance. I've been traveling, so I have, but I'm looking forward to sitting down and reading it.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah, it's a perfect example that there's all stuff that the creationists constantly call into question, and the scientists are going out there doing this great work, and they're figuring it out. We're coming up with answers all over the place from things that back when I was a graduate student, we would have said, no, that we won't learn that in our lifetimes. And, I'm wondering what we're going to be learning 10 years from now. It's just this avalanche of information, all of it confirming evolution and telling us all these wonderful stories about where it came from. And so we're seeing this, and at the same time, we're seeing these people who are just used to peddling ignorance. And it breaks our heart, okay? It's like you've got this wonderful novel or this great movie that you really, really love, and you know it's great, and you want to show it to everybody, and then you've got these yahoos who've never seen it who are trashing it, and picketing the theater and not letting people see it. It's something that just annoys you no end, and you want to break that logjam. I think that's another factor that's playing into a lot of people's science militancy, is that we love change. We want to see it out there. Yeah.
Ties so much to your kind of call for assistance. I got an invitation as the director of a museum in Wyoming, and the co-director and I were invited to debate Kent Hovind. And so at first we were like, okay, this will be really easy, this will be interesting, but what we ended up doing was a lot of research and watching some of these great evolutionary biologists who are fantastic scientists debating this guy, and they were getting warm.
Yeah.
Not because they didn't know the material, but because they didn't have the ability for rhetoric that he did. And that, how do you deal with that? I mean,
well, first of all, they don't have an ability for rhetoric. Ken Hovind's talks are awful. I've been to some of them. He goes on too long, like me. But I went to one talk where he talked for over 2 hours, and he used 750 PowerPoint slides. Any of you use PowerPoint? Have you ever done something like that where you train them out of 370 slides an hour? How do you do that? And he's just whipping through this stuff, and he's cracking jokes. He's not addressing the issues. He's making a lot of assertions with cornbone jokes, and actually he actually throws a lot of bigotry now. I was rather shocked that he was saying evil things about Jews and so forth, making typical stereotypical jokes about me and so forth, and appealing to the lowest common denominator, not putting out any information, but simply making assertions that appeal to their tribal sense. And if you're a scientist and you go into these sorts of things, your mission is different. It's let's get some information to these people. Let's talk about real science. Ken Hovind doesn't do that. Neither does Ken Ham. Neither do any of the creationists that you find out there. It's just noise thrown out at a rapid rate with a lot of buzzwords that appeal to people who are already indoctrinated in creationism. Yeah.
Along the lines he was mentioning, there was a book by Martin Gardner, which was published many years ago. It's called Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science. And he mentions the problems that scientists have debating kooks. Only he was talking about flat earth people who believe the earth is hollow on the inside and we're actually living in it. And he says that if you try to debate them, they will drive you nuts. because they don't have anything to do except work on their nutty theories. You actually have work to do.
Yeah.
But he, in there, he does have ways of dealing with people like that.
Right.
And he has ways of telling you how you can distinguish goofy science from the good science.
Yes. Yes. It's called the Gish Gallop, because Wayne Gish pioneered this thing. Where just throw out all the stuff over and over again. And it's not real science. It's nothing you can address specifically. I've been invited to a few debates, and I've actually done a few. And generally, what I found that you've got to do is you've got to stop the gallop before they get very far. That you have to be an aggressive, very assertive debater who doesn't let them get away with it. That if they start saying something, you grab the first piece of nonsense and you hammer them to death with it. That's the only way to do it. And you don't get off of that. You keep pounding on that one thing where they have totally screwed the pooch. Because you know what they can do is they can throw out a lie. It takes them 10 seconds to say it. It takes you an hour to give everybody the background to understand it. So it's a very difficult thing that you have to go in with extreme focus and address single points and make sure that, well, your goal isn't so much to inform the audience at that point. Your goal is to inform the audience of one simple fact, and that is that your opponent is a liar and an idiot. And it just demolishes their ability. That's all you can do in those kinds of debates. And it sounds so brutal and cruel, doesn't it? This is where we get a reputation for being mean atheists, but it's what you got to do.
I just have a question about, so you said that we don't want to teach atheism, it's not part of your job. However, part of your job, as you said at the beginning, you asked someone, how do you know that?
Yeah.
And that's something that one of my professors asked me, you know, 8 years ago, and that had a huge impact. If you think about, well, that leads to the kind of questions that leads a person to
Yes. What
I would consider rational thought. How do you know what you say you know? And is that something that you think that should be utilized in academia for trying to get people to go to that?
That, you know, the point is that you don't go to the classroom and tell the student what to believe about God and nature and all this stuff. What you do is you get them to ask questions that will lead them to a good answer. That will lead them to a satisfying answer to them. This is basic pedagogy, right? That instructing somebody about something doesn't get it across. It's when they do it themselves. I learned more biology the first year I had to teach than I did in all my years of classes. So, yeah, you're not going to tell them to be an atheist. You're going to tell them to question things, ask good questions, and pursue the answers. And in many cases, that will lead to atheism, but it won't necessarily lead to atheism. Many people come to an intermediate state, and that's okay.
Okay,
when people start walking out on the road. Anyway, you had a question. Oh, well.
Statistics, recent polls have shown that high school graduates in the United States, 95% of them are considered scientifically illiterate by compared to much of the rest of the world. A lot of those students will then go and become college graduates in non-scientific fields, and then become a part of the populace that you showed the statistic believes in creationism.
And they will vote, right.
And then from there, many of those people will then become part of society that determines what people in high school learn about science. Would you advocate then for higher standards in science teaching at the college level and hope that
yes.
kind of works its way down?
Yes. Any of you here are college educators, you know this. If you've been on the curriculum committee or something for your university, we all talk about this. That we always talk about things. Well, you know, I brought up the idea that all of our science majors, for instance, ought to take a philosophy course. We ought to throw a philosophy requirement. That all of our science, non-science majors ought to be required to take something a little bit more sophisticated than Rocks for Jocks, that they ought to have a little bit more math, a little bit more. And we all say these things, and we recognize that in the perfect world, this would be the ideal. But when we start adding up our ideals, we discover that our students will not graduate for 8 years. And parents don't like that. So there's real-world practicalities that get in the way of it. And every academic curriculum is a major compromise. It's a matter of setting priorities, and I would tend to lean towards more science in our basic curriculum. You know, there are many people who say, well, no, then we'll fail all our students or something. Yes, these are acrimonious debates that go on all the time in every university. I bet you they happen right here every year, right? Anyone know? Yeah, I bet. Okay, right here.
So you have tenure, which theoretically often would protect you from a lot of persecution. But I'm just curious, you mentioned briefly, how well has your administration supported you throughout Crackergate?
Yes, they have supported me very well, but indirectly by turning away and saying, oh, I don't want to hear this. And so, I don't expect my university administration to say that they support everything I do, because that would kind of defeat the purpose of academic freedom, which is to allow to piss off anybody you feel like, including university administrations. So, they've been good in the proper way. They haven't been saying, we support you, or we don't support you. They've just been saying, you have freedom to do this, and we're not going to interfere with it. So, that's what I hope for, that's what I got. I'm happy.
It seems that a lot of the success of the religious and creationist spread is due to their ability to kind of infiltrate our social infrastructure, in the sense that, the Texas Board of Education, president of the Board of Education of Texas, is a creationist himself.
Yes.
Is there any kind of backlash from the scientific community, like a scientific martyr of sorts, that kind of goes into their system? They're allowed to kind of break into our system.
Yes.
But, you being an atheist, you never go to the Archdiocese and become a Catholic priest or something.
Oh, some do, actually. I mean, I think there's a lot of atheists in the Catholic Church. But, of course, they're not going to make a big noise about it.
I guess my question is, where are the scientists when there's an election for the Board of Education?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's a level of civic action, right, that we should be taking part in. We should be running for school boards and so forth. I actually proposed to run for the school board in my town, and I proposed this at a meeting of our Democratic committee there, and they all looked at me in horror. So this is one reason is. It's really hard for somebody with our rather comparatively radical views to get elected.
Okay. Oh,
so that's a tough one. I mean, some people can do it, but I'm not very diplomatic, so I guess it's a good thing they've talked me out of it. But anyway, so that's one issue. The other is numbers. How many scientists are there in this country? Mm-hmm. It's under a million, right? How many fanatical Christians are there? Far right wing Christians.
Too many.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but there's about 20 million, so they outnumber us right there. Okay, they don't have a real majority in this country, but they outnumber this one little interest group, which means that they're rightfully in a democratic society more greatly represented. What I'm trying to get across here, though, is that. One thing they have in their favor is fanaticism, right? They believe very strongly. And what we have lacked on our side is an equal fervor. That, like Lawrence Krauss's argument here, he's saying, no, don't make them angry. And that's a reasonable thing to say, but it's not the kind of thing they think about on the other side, right? You do not think that Pat Robertson stopped them at, well, if I... if I damn the lesbians to hell, they'll be angry at me. Maybe I shouldn't do that. But he doesn't think that way. And I think we have to stop thinking that way, too. We have to be more assertive about our positions, even if it does make people angry. So that's one thing I'm saying, is let's build up a strong atheist core that is willing to openly speak out on these issues and express their point of view without reservation, without saying we ought to soften it to make it easier for the other side. Yeah?
I really admire your performative deconstruction of certain religious mythology, but given the fact that the last 100 years, most of the productive scientists have been secular humanists.
Yes.
And if you look at our graduate schools now, mostly more and more of our top scientists are coming from Asia, India, and Europe, and more of our scientists are leaving to go to these areas. So in another 5 years or so, as the decline of this country continues, there'd probably be a significant backlash against the suppression of science. Don't you think we're looking at just, the numbers are there when you think why, you know who's going to become the best scientists anyway. They tend to get tight and fooled. So why struggle?
I have been telling myself that since the Reagan years, okay? And it hasn't happened. It just keeps getting indefinitely postponed. And like I said, have we gone beyond the point of no return? And I don't know. We may have. That the outrage of a tiny minority may have no impact at all when we're living under Sarah Palin or something. That's kind of wishful thinking. Let's hope it gets better, because it's hard to imagine it getting worse, but it has gotten worse every year, every election cycle. It's just, I lived through Ronald Reagan. I never imagined anybody could be worse, and then George W. Bush came along. It just shows that human imagination is not capable of grasping the depths to which we can sink. That's all I know. Okay, one more. Yes.
We talked a lot about how the standards of science education in the U.S. are sort of deplorable. Why do you think the U.S. is so secularist in these things compared to Europe or other countries?
We're more religious.
Why do you think that is?
I blame evolution, actually. this was a country that early on set up this principle of religious freedom and said that we will allow anyone to believe anything they want. And what it created is this marvelous ecosystem for crazy ideas. And the most savage, ruthless, evil ideas have won out. The craziest ideas that still are viable have survived. And so, it's just been this hothouse where we've grown some... look at Mormonism. Can you believe people actually spoke? Or Scientology. how did that happen? How did anybody see that the first time and accept it? And it's just that in this country, that kind of thing thrives. You're not allowed to question it. Sure, if somebody says it's a religion, you don't argue with it. You just say, okay, well, you go your way. And that just lets it build and build and build. So yeah, natural selection has led to the current situation. Okay.